All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Well, hello and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective. And tonight, we're going to be talking about The Birdcage, the Robin Williams and Nathan Lane comedic gold movie from 1996. It is 25 years young these days, and we are going to have an excellent guest, a returning guest. He was on for High Rise a couple of years, not a couple of years ago, like last year, and he's back again for this one. And before we introduce him on the last night's portion of the show, let's say hello to my friend Robert, co-host extraordinaire, hetero life mate, and all the rest. How are things going over there on your side of the heat exchange, where it's going to be real hot next week?
Yeah, this is going to be a great episode. I feel like we're a cable news show where you have the two talking heads and they bring in the expert. So James is going to be our gay expert. It's going to be fantastic.
I want to do an African TV station interview with him.
Yes.
I tried that.
Why are you a gay?
Anyway,
that's good stuff.
Yeah,
good stuff.
How are you handling the heat over there? You already got heat stroke. Really, I can hear it in your slurred words and nonsense.
I am speaking rather poorly. I'm getting more and more tan. I am further darkening my skin tone, which is an endless journey of mine. But no, I've been getting some swimming. I've been doing a lot of swimming at the local lakes, and it is a fantastic way to cool down. If you have all day to laze around, I highly recommend it. Unless you're like working or being productive in some way, in which case, you know, do that instead. But if you can, if you have the means, stay cool.
Stay cool. Stay frosty. Now, are you doing the, I can't even like place a scene, but I've seen this scene in numerous movies, and they're usually like period pieces, like from the 1800s or set in that period of time, where this young group of people, boys and girls, will go to a swimming hole and disrobe, and then they're swimming in there naked to beat the heat. Is that what's going on here? I just need, you know, for the visuals, because it's, you know, The Birdcage tonight.
I mean, you could imagine what it would be like if there wasn't a world of cell phones everywhere. Maybe there would be some people jumping in with the skivvies. I think that was more of a case of the market not providing, Daniel, the swimsuits. Wasn't swimwear like first became a thing in like the early 1900s, like 1910s?
Yeah, but it was like full get up, right? I've seen those old photos. It's they're pretty serious gear.
You're not showing a lot of skin, but those all might also been like swimwear designed for the northeastern seaboard, right? Like those are the first people to buy it, and it's like cold there. I don't know. I really don't know.
But they were like really prudish.
Yeah. Yeah, you get the Puritans, right? Mm-hmm. Right, Daniel? Mm-hmm.
The
society
no
hadn't decayed yet to the point where wet ass pussy is the number one song. It just hadn't decayed to that point yet. People still had a modicum of decency. And, you know, you're still leaving something to the imagination for your, you know, your wedding night, right?
Right. Yeah, as it should be.
That's right. That's right, Daniel. Yeah. So Daniel, I appreciate how you came prepared for the show tonight. It is Pride Month. You got the gay haircut. You got the shaved face. You got the, I don't know what kind of a thing that you're wearing on your chest, but you're looking really, really metro. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you. I used to live in an area of Seattle known for its prideness, and I was accepted among the people living there. In fact, early on, I was eagerly accepted, though I declined. But it seemed as I aged, and you do seem to age rapidly in that circle, and we'll talk about that with our guest, James. But basically, when I was about 23, 24, I was getting a lot of attention. And then when I was like 28, not so much.
You have aged out. It's sad. It's sad. I know. James was talking about that. We'll get his opinion. It'll be fantastic. Although it seems like, I mean, there's definitely, I don't know, do twinks have a lifespan? Like they age and then they get to, once you're 20.
Well, we're going to have to defer to the expert, but I would imagine, and this is, you know, I'm by no means an expert, but it seems to me that it means like a young person.
Yeah, we'll find out. We will find out all those questions and more coming up on this episode of whatever show this is.
Well, it's the Actual Anarchy Podcast right now.
That's what I meant. More. That's what I said, right?
ActualAnarchy.com/240. But we're about to do The Last Nighters, which we'll do right about now, my funk soul brother. Hey everyone, it's Daniel Elwood, and Robert Paul Johnson is my hetero life mate and co-host, and we are The Last Nighters. You can find us at the Liberty Movement's YouTube channel and also at lastnighters.com. This is episode, 183 of the show. You can find the show notes more at lastnighters.com/183. And tonight, by Twitter poll decree, we're going to slip it into the back end of Pride Month with a review of the Robin Williams, Nathan Lane comedy classic, The Birdcage, with James Gentleman of Blackbird. Is a podcast that I was featured on the previous iteration when it was called The Urban Agorist. And then he was on with us for High Rise just last year with a very, very good episode about a not very good movie. And dare we tempt the fates again and do it yet another time? We will see as we introduce our guest, the great James Gentleman, rainbow pride flag and all. Welcome back to the show. And why don't you tell our audience where they can find your show and their Paloma Verde CBD oil or CBD whatever's, and which promo code to use.
Hello, boys and girls. It's great to be back to talk to you about this great movie. You can find me at blackbird.substack.com. I don't talk about movies, and I'm not nearly as irreverent as we will inevitably be on my show. This is more of a straight-laced thing. Paloma Verde. Oh my God. So Paloma Verde is one of my sponsors, and we were talking about that on the Patreon feed, which you should definitely join. Get these guys some money, but you can get me some money if you go to PalomaVerdeCBD.com and use offer code Blackbird to check out and get 25% off your order.
So you keep it straight on your show.
I pretty much do. Yeah. Like, I mean, sometimes gender ironic, comes up every so often. Yeah. Like we were saying, man, like the whole gay thing doesn't really matter anymore. We're no longer like the oppressed class or whatever. Like, I mean,
we're over it. Gay. We're pretty much over the whole gay thing.
But we are over you right now in the visual, and that's not intentional. It's not intentional. Yes, but
it's cool. Y'all are topping me. It's fine.
It's true.
So anyway, this should be a fun movie. This won a Twitter poll. It was going to be this or Network, and I thought Network would have been good because we could talk about, you know, the mainstream media and how they're full of shit all the time. But there actually are a few lines related to that in this one. And then after The Birdcage won the Twitter poll, one of the stars of Network died. And so I'm like, oh, if only we had done the poll a couple days later, then we would be doing Network right now. But I think this is appropriate. This will work. This will be just fine. It'll be a lot of fun.
Way to kill the buzz, Daniel.
Yeah, I know. Really? We had so much good energy. 40 minutes of pre-show bonus content at lastnighters.com/Patreon. We was like zingers all across the board. And then I just say something about somebody dying and just fuck it all up. Anyway, you can probably show us some more for this one at lastnighters.com/183. We'll have links to James's podcast and his prior appearance where he was on talking about High Rise. And we'll even have that Paloma Verde CBD link and a reminder to use the word Blackbird as the promo code for 25% off at checkout. Save some money.
Slipping it into the back end of Pride Month was a very funny turn of phrase, Daniel. I want to point that out because I'm not sure if everyone caught it. You guys have hundreds of thousands of listeners. And if there was one who didn't catch that, then that would be a shame. So,
well, slight correction: hundreds, potentially 1,000 listeners. Not hundreds.
It's all
of
on
thousands.
Where you put the comma.
Yes.
Yeah.
Whatever. You know, maybe after all this monetary expansion, with all the inflation, you know,
maybe audience we'll get... inflation too, huh? Is that how it works?
That's how
it works. Come on, President Biden.
He's threatening us with a good time. All right. So, speaking of a good time, let's get into this. We usually start with the Google description, so I'm going to add this to the screen. There it is. All right. This can be hard to read, I think. But The Birdcage came out in 1996, 1996, 1996, as my high school mascot cheerleaders would say, starring Robin Williams and Nathan Lane and Gene Hackman and Hank Azaria, among others. Got a 7.1 out of 10 on the IMDb, 81% Rotten Tomatoes, 4.6 out of 5 on Vudu, and 89% of Google users like it. In this remake of the classic French farce, La Cage aux Folles, I'm saying it in German, kind of, engaged couple Val Goldman, played by Dan Futterman, who we have not heard of since, and Barbara Keeley, Calista Flockhart, shakily introduce their future in-laws, Val's father, Armand, played by Robin Williams, a gay Miami drag club owner, pretends to be a straight and attempts to hide his relationship with Albert, played by Nathan Lane, his life partner and the club's flamboyant star attraction, so as to please Barbara's father, controversial Republican Senator Kevin Keeley, played by Gene Hackman, came out March 8th, 1996, directed by Mike Nichols, and features the song prominently at the beginning and ending, We Are Family. Robert, your take on the opening. Please.
Yes, The Birdcage, starring the great Robin Williams. Every time I watch Robin Williams, I'm my dad is the exact same age as Robin Williams, and he reminds me of Robin Williams. So it's kind of weird watching him. I want to say that this role reminds me the most of my dad. And he barely plays a gay guy in this movie. But apparently he does. He's more like just a guy in a relationship with a gay guy. More like, I don't know, whatever. He doesn't play it up like Hank Azaria plays it up in the movie. I think that this movie, you know, movies are time capsules and timing is everything in comedy. And like we talked about in the pre-show, the world is just kind of over. Like gay people, like it was a thing and it was like risque and like hilarious for like, oh, look at how gay those people are. Now it's like, yeah, okay. I mean, I know James thinks this is a fantastic movie, and I think at one point it was. I think it had a real impact, and of course it made a lot of people gay, as the movies do, right? But I just, watching it in 2021, it all kind of fell flat for me, like how outrageous people were and how flamboyant some of the characters were. It was like, yeah, been there, done that. I've seen this a million times in media. It wasn't like particularly outrageous or, you know, I think it's a movie that kind of plays on the outrageousness of it in order to get a lot of laughs. And I think in 1996, it probably worked really, really well. But
what's the name of the movie that worked really, really well, Robert?
Womp.
Oh, my God.
That was really bad. But thank you. You could show yourself out.
And people listening to this on the audio feed have no idea what just happened.
Yeah.
No, they know I've trained them that a womp means that I put the logo up.
Oh, okay.
It's like Pavlov. They now are salivating.
Okay. They're salivating for more beautiful content.
That's right.
They also can't see my purple lipstick, like somehow disembodying from my lips and going onto my glass every time I take a sip. So maybe you should watch the video, plebs.
That's right. Watch the video. Check it out. It's fantastic. But yeah, anyway, the movie didn't make me laugh. It wasn't outrageous, but it was still like a good, simple story told in an interesting way. So I still liked it. I still thought it was a well-made film. I thought that the characters were all fairly well realized. It ended strongly with a strong, heartfelt moment. You know, it had a good message for the most part, but it just played, I don't know, it kind of played alien, like it was almost like from a simpler time that was made for a more naive audience. Mm-hmm. That was going to impact them more and be more outrageous. But for me, my jaded, you know, 45-year-old 2021 eyeballs, it was more kind of quaint and just quaint. It was just more of a, just a good story done well, told well, featuring good acting, but it didn't hit me like it probably would have back then. I don't even know if this movie really hit me hard back then. Because even then I was like, you know, Dan and I grew up being fairly libertarian left socially, like growing up through the 80s, the Republicans were really like getting into the bedroom, get the gays. The gays are the big problem. And we were like, yeah, just let them do what they want to do. They're not hurting anybody. Just leave them alone. And so this movie was like, yeah, okay. I don't, I thought it was good. It didn't make me laugh. And that's what I'm going to judge the comedy on. I'll judge the merits of the story differently. I think that's well strong. But the best character I thought was Nathan Lane. I thought he was, when he was dressed up in drag as the Mrs. lady, I forget her name, Mrs. whatever.
Mrs. Goldman or Coleman.
Right. I thought that was actually some strong dialogue that held up. And other than that, maybe the senator guy played by, come on,
Gene Hackman,
of course, he held up. The characters all really held up for the most part, but just the outrageousness wasn't there for me. So it didn't, you know, I think it loses a lot of the humor when you're not outraged by the action going on screen.
Yeah, I think that this is a time capsule type movie. And I remember seeing it back when it came out. I think I saw it in theaters. And I enjoyed the movie more then than I do now, looking back, because then it was more groundbreaking. It was like cultural, like sea change, you know, and it's one of the things we've talked about this many times, where you'll see things introduced into the culture to sort of acclimate them to the greater or, you know, wider acceptance. Right. So like this is around the time when we saw Gunther, the gay barista in Friends. And we saw Will and Grace being on primetime TV, things like that. And I think those go into the cultural milieu. I'm stealing James's word here.
Thanks.
To sort of float these ideas out there into the consciousness, right? And make them more acceptable. But now that it's, you know, 20, 30 years later, 25 years later, I guess, this isn't edgy anymore. This is mainstream. It's kind of blasé. It's kind of whatever.
It's tame compared to what the lefties are doing these days.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. This is very tame. But back, you know, 25 years ago, it was fairly cutting edge. Like you kind of had to be hip to be down with this, to be like, oh yeah, okay, you know, this is funny. And Robin Williams, of course, is great. Nathan Lane, I think his performance is really good. Though I kept watching this recently. I'm like, Does anyone actually act like that? Like in real life? Like, is anyone like, would, and James, I'll defer to you from a gay person's perspective. And if you have a pulse on the, you know, the community, would they view Nathan Lane's performance as a caricature that is like inappropriate, problematic, or whatever the, you know, lefty term du jour is? Or is he playing like somebody that, you know, everyone knows? Like, is this a normal kind of person, flamboyant? I mean, I've hung out with a ton of gay people and I've never encountered somebody as Nathan Lane portrays, you know?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. The Nathan Lane character is definitely an exaggerated caricature, but it's not even like an exaggeration of anything. It's so their relationship is that stereotype where like there's the man and the woman, and like every gay relationship has the male and the female role. It's never been true. Now we know it's not true. Everyone has a gay couple in their life probably. And they know that like, more often than not, it's two kind of effeminate people or two kind of masculine people. And that's, you know, I mean, people get along with people like them. That, you know, that said, I wouldn't consider Nathan Lane's character problematic. I don't think most people would either. Hank Azaria's character has been characterized as problematic by some people. Although, I think Agador Spartacus is one of the greatest characters in cinema history. I think he's great. And I think a lot of people agree with me. He's just hilarious. But no, Nathan Lane's character, first of all, he's a drag queen, and drag queens are tough. They're not girly. And not to say that Nathan Lane's character isn't tough, but he's definitely girly and sensitive. And, you know, that's just that rubs counter to sort of what we know today about drag queens. That said, I don't know. I think this movie was made in reaction to the religious right. Maybe it wasn't like a pro gay movie so much as a anti religious right movie.
Like in your face, religious right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of thing that Robert was talking about earlier, where we grew up, we were left leaning in the social sense because we saw that it was the Christian conservatives trying to limit speech and limit music and cultural things and whatnot. But you can also see a shift where it's almost like a planned thing where, you know, things are kind of floated out there and then they become more and more acceptable. And I think to a point, that's a good thing. But then it starts to push boundaries even further. And so now there's things that I think are not okay that are kind of being promoted. You know what I mean? And it's really hard to say something without like getting canceled or demonetized here. But, you know, there are things that I think were taboo even 5 years ago that are now being promoted, but they're crimes. You know, like I'm talking about like young kids, that kind of thing, you know, like that's in some things I've seen, like that's being like attempted to be normalized.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to bridge too far.
You're not talking about drag queen story hour. You're talking about like minor attracted persons or whatever.
Right.
Being
a sexual preference
as just another sexual orientation.
Right. Yeah. Right. Though I'm not a big fan of the drag queen story hour either, but
sure. But that's not a crime. Like, right. I guess I'm of two minds with the drag queen story hour thing. Like I don't really believe in like cultural degeneracy. It's just not something I really think about or worry about or necessarily even think is a thing. I think culture changes. I don't think it degenerates or generates. I think it's just change. So that's kind of where I see the drag queen story hour thing. But that having been said, the idea that little kids are ready to explore gender identity and sexual orientation, maybe even especially sexual orientation, I think that's probably problematic. They're not ready for that. And I don't know if this is indicative of my growing up to be a gay man or if this is perfectly normal. I've actually frankly never talked to straight people about it. But when I was little, like 3, 4, maybe, I used to dress up in my mom's high heels and put on her lipstick and stuff like that. And that to me seemed just fun. Like it wasn't because I was attracted to boys. It was just, you know, it's what I wanted to do. So I did it.
It makes sense. I mean,
and it's not because I was at drag queen story hour. It was just because that was where my, you know, play inclination was at the time.
Yeah. I mean, my kids do dress up all the time and it, you know, they'll role play and it doesn't matter, you know, if they're boy or girl or whatever. They're just having a good time.
My sister was a total tomboy. She's, you know, she's straight. She's got a husband and a kid and everything. But, when she was really little, she was what we called back then a tomboy. I don't know if that's still a thing. It would not surprise me if she were coming of age today, if she would have, identified as non-binary or transgender or something like that at a very early age and then just kind of outgrown it, as happens so often.
Yeah, that's a thing that I've kind of noticed, and I feel like I'm treading dangerous territory here again, but we were at a park a couple of years ago and my kids were trying to get up and play on this zip line thing and they were taking turns with this other person, and this other person was definitely a girl and probably 13, 14 years old. And I said, oh, you got to, you know, let her go first. And then you guys take turns and whatever. And this person said to me, oh, I'm not a girl. Hmm. But they were presenting, how do I say this right? Like they were trying to present that they were not a girl, but they appear to be a girl, very much so. You know what I mean? Like, and so in my mind, I'm like, okay, I want to respect what this person is saying, but I, you know, I slipped a couple of times, you know, and I'm like, well, okay. So then I started thinking, like, is this because this is now cool? You know, like, this is the thing to identify as something because now you get notoriety or popularity or whatever, you know, because like when you're in your formative years, you're malleable. Seek attention, things that are trends and fads, they affect you. And there's hormones blasting all over the place, you know, and people are very, seeking out for, you know, identity and attention and fitting in and all of these things. So it sort of goes to the point you were saying earlier about your sister. Like if she was growing up now, she might think those things for a time, but then you said outgrow them. And I just wonder how much like just being an adolescent and being and going through those phases is maybe exaggerated or exacerbated or encouraged by this, you know, popularity or this notoriety kind of aspect.
Yeah. Like we were talking on the pre-show, I mean, 10, 15 years ago, everybody was bisexual. That was just the thing. Like girls were making out with girls, boys, not so much making out with boys, but you know, I mean, it was not uncommon to see two ostensibly straight guys grinding on each other in a club. You know, I mean, there's something to be said for that sort of exploration. Typically, people will outgrow it, or maybe outgrow it is the wrong word. They will, you know, evolve in their self-discovery or whatever to the point where they realize that, yeah, that the sex that I was assigned at birth matches my actual psychological gender, and I'm a straight person, and I'm going to get married and have kids and live a quote-unquote normal life. For me, getting back to the movie, I thought this came out when I was in fifth grade, but it actually came out when I was in seventh grade. I was, you know, I was a kid. I wasn't tiny, but I was a kid, right on the cusp of adolescence. And I think by that time, I kind of knew that I was different from the other boys, so to speak. And the trailers for this movie came out, and I was desperate to see it. I wanted to see it so bad. It was rated R, so I couldn't go see it on my own. I told my uncle, who was an evangelical Christian, that I wanted to see it. And his initial reaction was, oh, that disgusts me. And so of course that drove me a little bit deeper into the closet. But eventually
did it also make you want to see it more?
I don't know. I don't know what impact it had on me that way.
Okay. I just know whatever I tell my kids, no, they want it all the more.
Yeah. I think I was definitely taken aback. I didn't want to talk to my uncle about it anymore for sure. But when it came out, so my dad was a like executive for a restaurant company. And so every month, one of my siblings or I, we get to go on like a date night with my parents. We would go to one of the restaurants that the company he worked for owned. And that was usually it. But that month I got to go to the restaurant. We dressed real nice. We went to the restaurant and then we went and saw The Birdcage. We never went to movies when I was a kid. If we did, it was like the Dollar Theater where, you know, it was like the second run movies and stuff. So we went to see this movie and it was so affirming. It was just great. It was a really good experience to see that with my parents, especially, and not to have them, they were Republicans, they were conservatives. I wouldn't consider them like on the religious right. We were Catholic. My dad always described himself as socially liberal and fiscally conservative. So like the Gary Johnson version of libertarian, but you know, I mean, he listened to Rush Limbaugh and all that stuff. I mean, he was a 90s conservative. But they weren't disgusted by it or repulsed or anything like that. So yeah, I mean, it was cool. It was a great movie. We thought it was hilarious. I didn't come out obviously for another several years, but you know, it had a good impact on my formation personally. I don't think a movie like this would be made today. I don't think you're going to have like we were saying, the gay thing is no longer a big deal. It's now kind of moved on to transgender or non-binary, but you wouldn't have a movie like this made today because it's no longer subversive. The cultural powers that be are the left. Mm-hmm. A movie like this would need to be like a right-wing movie, but you could never make that, obviously. I don't know what a right-wing version of this would be other than maybe like I don't know. Curtis Yarvin mentions Moldbug. He talks about the kid who, you know, he's a white kid. He's 14 years old. He goes to his guidance counselor and his guidance counselor tells him that, you know, well, because you're white, you're privileged and you're, you know, if you hold these views, then you're a Nazi. And the kid says, well, fuck it. I'm a Nazi then. And he just becomes a Nazi. And that's like how a 14-year-old becomes a Nazi, is just in complete reaction to being told that he's a Nazi.
Wait, are we doing American History X?
No, we're not. That's the thing. He doesn't do curb stomps and stuff. He just wants to be subversive. He wants to be countercultural. And to me, that's the kind of movie that if Hollywood were not run by left-wingers would be made today. It wouldn't do well. It would not be as successful as The Birdcage, which made like $128 million or something like that, which, you know, back then was a shit ton of money.
Before all the inflation. Thanks, yeah. Fed.
Thanks, Fed. Audience inflation, though. That's a good thing. We got to.
Yes. Yeah. Grow those numbers. Pump that. Those are rookie numbers. Got to pump them up.
So I don't know. I don't want to tread too deep into like right-wing waters because I'm not right-wing at all. Other than the fact that, you know, I'm libertarian. So I guess some people would consider that inherently right-wing. But it's a subversive movie. It's a countercultural movie, and the counterculture today is on the right. It just is.
Yeah, yeah. Johnny Rotten had a quote about that. He's like, "Never thought I'd see the day when like the conservative culture is considered the punk culture now." You know?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I'm butchering the quote, of course, because that's what I do. But yeah, it's really kind of wild, like that the progressive left narrative is sort of mainstream now. And it preaches tolerance and acceptance and science and debating ideas and being open-minded, but it's anything but any of those things. It's so bizarre.
Jeff Deist from the Mises Institute was on a podcast recently, and I can't remember which podcast it was, but he said, so back up a little bit, Vin Armani, who for some reason his name has to come up on every single libertarian podcast ever. But he has been talking about for the last year this new age of magic, where, you know, we're no longer worried about reason and logic and that sort of thing. Jeff Deist put it really succinctly and put it in a way that I think libertarians can understand a little bit better than magic, which doesn't, it's not a thing. He said that logic has been replaced by rhetoric. These two legs on the three-legged stool of the trivium have swapped places. We're no longer worried about making an argument or like forming a rational opinion. All we care about is that power that comes from having the right soundbite or having the right like words to say.
The 140 characters.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially that. Especially that.
Age. It's the age of the bullies. It's, yep. You can't win an argument online, but you can bully someone into silence. So you can just bully somebody, call them a bigot, homophobe, racist, sexist, whatever, and then they'll shut up, and then you'll be like, "Hey, I won."
And kind of a parallel to that is knowledge has been replaced by belief. I mean, and that goes across the political spectrum. It's not just the trust the science people who have turned science into like a literal religion with their mask talismans and their vaccine sacraments. And their Fauci priests and deities. But if you just look at the way QAnon operates, I mean, that on the right, they've got this thing where Trump is a messiah. And
he's orange, you know, Jesus.
Yeah, Steve Bannon is the prophet. It's nuts. It's absolutely insane how the last year or maybe 5 years, I don't really know, has turned us from like an enlightenment or kind of like a modern / postmodern society into this weird caricature of all of those things.
Yeah. I wonder if it just exposed something that was there the whole time or if it's driving it, you know, I think social media has a big thing to do with it, but also back when mainstream media was controllable, you know, where a few entities could, you know, you had three or four channels. So this is like kind of before cable, and there were like one or two major newspapers in each city. It wasn't so hard to control the narrative. And then with the explosion of the internet, or even, you know, cable TV, you could kind of have an expansion of thought and expression. Yeah. And now it's like a tamping down of it again. And I don't know if you get that genie back in that bottle all that well. I mean, I'm sort of being proven wrong because 98% of people seem to be going along with all this stuff. But for those that can see, it seems like they're overplaying their hand. I mean, they're, if anyone cares about logic or consistency, they'll see the farce for what it is, but they're also so inured Matrix style that they're not willing to see it.
And they're also getting bullied anytime they stick their head up. So, you know, that's hard to fight against.
Right. Because they keep you kind of isolated in a way where you don't realize how many more people agree with you, you know, because it's the very vocal minority. I saw some stat about like some odd 90% of tweets are just done by, you know, 10% of the accounts, and it's predominantly Democrat, you know, leaning like by a wide margin, but they're very prominent, very amplified, you know, vocally. And so it appears that it's a bellwether or a barometer of thought in the culture, when in the reality, it's a very small cadre of the milieu that are, see, I'm abusing your word here.
Yeah,
I haven't even used it once since we switched over to this feed. Jesus.
But you get what I'm saying, right? It's like it has an outsized appearance of acceptance, but it's all smoke and mirrors, right? It's not real, but they've effectively like siphoned off people enough to where they're separated enough to where they can be individually bullied without being aware of how many more people agree with them. Am I saying that right? I'm trying to make a point here.
Right.
Yeah. Rings true to me. I think, if you take like just a huge bird's eye view of human history, we have like a series of eras, or maybe epochs, however you pronounce that, that start out with like a propositional way of seeing the world that, and they always end with an impositional way of like enforcing that worldview. So like, for instance, the like pre-Christian era started out with like nature worshipers and, you know, let's all get along. Yeah. There's wars here and there. But they're tribal. They're not massive world wars. And that ends with the Roman Empire, which has just taken over the world and has imposed Roman values on everyone. But the Roman Empire is now replaced with this Christian milieu or era where, you know, Christianity is, it's a little bit countercultural. It's a little bit subversive. But it rings true to a lot of people. And so, you know, they propose this method of redeeming yourself with the deity, and you know, it feels good to a lot of people. And so Christianity becomes the ascendant way of seeing the world. And I'm speaking obviously just of Western civilization. But I think probably in the East, you can probably see this as well with their dynasties and things like that. So Christianity becomes like the ascendant thing in, say, like the 4th century AD or so. And by the time you get to the Protestant Reformation and the maybe century or so after that, Christianity becomes not a propositional thing, but an impositional thing where they're now burning people at the stake and doing witch hunts and things like that. So something new has to take this place because this tyranny can't last. And so you get the Enlightenment and the modern age where people are valuing reason over faith. They're valuing science and economics and all of this. And this is something that, you know, not only like Adam Smith, but also Karl Marx. It's a very materialistic way of seeing society and the world. So maybe that's kind of the another oscillation is that you between like a spiritual and a material way of seeing things and interacting with the world. So you usher in this modern age where reason supplants faith as the predominant way of seeing the world. And then that ends with like the dropping of the nuclear bomb, where science and reason become this world destroying thing. And then, you know, you also get kind of caricatures of it. Like Ayn Rand, for instance, is just like the caricature of a modern philosopher. Like if you compare Kant and Ayn Rand, she sounds a little bit like him, but she also sounds insane. So you go from the modern era to the postmodern era, which is postmodernism is a lot less materialist and a lot more esoteric and individualist. And even though the postmodernists are caricatured as being collectivists, they're really not. My personal experience and my personal identity supersede anything that you believe about norms and mores and things like that. But now we're seeing the postmodern become the impositional force, where they are the drivers of culture and the punitive, the enforcers of these morals and values that drive society. And so they are now going to have to be replaced by something else. And I don't know if it's going to be like another materialist age or maybe another spiritual age. The oscillation might not match the turning of the eras. But like this thing is going to have to come crashing and burning. And I hope it happens soon because it's fucking scary, really. I mean, I hope that we don't have nuclear bombs and gulags and stuff like that, that ended the modern era. The other thing is they get shorter and shorter. So like the pre-Christian era was, you know, 1,000 years or so. The Christian era was only a few hundred. The modern era was only a couple hundred. The postmodern is only a few decades. If I'm right.
Acceleration. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
Why did I even say that? What were we talking about before? And what does this have to do with the birdcage?
What the fuck were we talking about? Yeah, I don't even know. So let's talk about the movie a little bit. So it has been 25 years. I think it did have a cultural impact at the time, though I think you watch it again today and it's like not as impactful. So in some ways, at least for me, it's like not as good. And Robert, you mentioned in your open that you thought that this was a interesting story told well. I disagree. I felt like I was left hanging at the end of this movie.
Yeah.
I needed a happy ending.
Dude.
I needed something to happen. Yes.
Happy ending after myself.
Because yeah. All they do is escort the guy out of the club to We Are Family, which is like, you know, overplayed.
They get married. What else do you want?
That's at the credits, post-credit scene. I mean, that's like, yeah. You know. But there are some things that are sort of alluded to that must have been cut from the story. Like one of the cameramen notices that it's the senator leaving, but nothing comes of that. And then they end on this joke, which is not a terrible joke. He's like, meet me on the corner of 20th and whatever in 20 minutes. And he's like, not for $1 million. I mean, that was like the one thing I was laughing about other than the Hank Azaria character, which I agree. He was hilarious in this, but I find it surprising that he would walk back like playing characters on The Simpsons. Did he express regret for this
thing with Apu?
Yeah.
God.
It's just bizarre.
Well, I mean, that just speaks to who the cultural powers are. I mean, you know, back then, I mean, we do say that the religious right had a lot of power back then, but they were on their downslope, I guess. They did, though. I mean, this was right around the time that Newt Gingrich took over Congress. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's not. But you're right. I think that it did leave us hanging a little bit. I would love to have seen like the redemption arc of the senator, Gene Hackman's character.
Yeah, it's sort of assumed with the wedding happening. You know, it's assumed that he becomes okay with it, but we don't really see. That happened.
You want Gene Hackman to have like an arc. You want the old stodgy senator to all of a sudden embrace his new gay family.
Yeah. Yeah. I want something there because he's also just a caricature.
It was one evening. It's a movie about one day.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot to ask of any character to have a complete arc in a single day. I mean, I know that it happens in movies and Hollywood accelerates things unrealistically. But I thought it told a fairly realistic, albeit quaint, story of these stodgy, waspy people, you know, blue bloods, getting caught up in this South Beach lifestyle and going, you know, fish out of water style thing. You know, it It doesn't play as hard as it did, but it's still authentic for, I mean, authentic, but for a story idea, you know, like the fish out of water story, there's a million of them and they work because people can identify with it in theory, or you can imagine what it would be like if you were a stodgy blue blood and you were presented with, oh, this is your new family now. You could be like, oh, well, wouldn't that be a shock to the system? Waka waka. You know,
should be a screenwriter, Robert.
I should be, man. I'd be so good.
I don't know. I found Gene Hackman's character to be a caricature of like all the terrible attributes of conservatives, you know, and the hypocrisy of them, you know, like, yeah, I'm, you know, president of this like moral society thing. Yet he's caught with an underage prostitute. And of course they make a point of, and they're black, you know, it's like,
you know, as if that's- I know. Is this, so I don't know. I mean, think of all the Republican politicians who have been caught either doing sexually like bad things.
Right. But I don't think it's isolated to them. I just think that it's more noticed. It's
definitely called out more.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. What's Gary Hart? I don't know though, man, like Democrat politicians have affairs. Republican politicians like are in weird, kinky, gay relationships in airports and shit. Like,
remind me, who was the guy running for governor in Florida?
I don't know. Well, I don't, I'm sorry. I don't know that story. What's the deal?
Oh, you don't know Andrew Gillum?
Uh-uh.
Oh, all right. Yeah. He was running against DeSantis and he was, you know, Democrat, progressive type.
He, like cocaine and hookers, gay hookers, right?
Yeah. He was found in a hotel room, passed out after ingesting a bunch of meth or something along those lines with a gay prostitute. I mean, whatever, you know, I don't care, but you know, but maybe this is the point, James, that it wasn't as scandalous as if it had been a Republican doing it. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
It's just people tune into the hypocrisy, right? I mean, the lefties, Democrats are supposedly the party of liberal value, you know, whatever. And then the Republicans are supposedly the conservatives that are supposed to be against it, but yet secretly they're getting it on. It's a little bit more scandalous, I suppose.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I can see that because it is a little bit more hypocritical for them because they would speak against it versus the other side would be more embracing of that. And so, okay. Yeah. If they're doing it, it's whatever, you know?
Right. I don't know. It's all very quaint these days. Yeah,
it does. It just feels a little bit dated. Like I have a nostalgic connection to this movie. So that's why I liked it. Although I did show it to my partner my boyfriend is significantly younger than I am. There's not a generation gap, but there's definitely like an age gap. We're like on the extremes of the millennial spectrum, I guess. And he liked it, which is surprising because he doesn't like any of my 90s movies.
Hmm.
I mean, I have terrible taste in movies. You've seen High Rise. So take that with a grain of salt, but he really liked The Birdcage. And he didn't like it because it's a gay movie either. That's not a selling point for him any more than it is for me. So I think it does, you know, I mean, it aged well, if a little bit.
But it couldn't have outraged him. Like,
oh God, you
know,
no.
Like,
but nothing, like, nothing outrages him. He's even less sensitive to that kind of thing than I am.
Right. So this wouldn't have been any kind of time capsule. It wouldn't have been any kind of, I mean, I think a lot of the laughs come from the Hank Azaria character being outrageously gay and the Nathan Lane character being outrageously gay. Whereas it is so old hat watching it in 2021 that it's like cute, you know?
It is cute. It's cute. And like, I don't know. For some reason, I think the Hank Azaria character has aged the best. Like the Robin Williams, Nathan Lane relationship has not aged well because we all, like I said earlier, we all know gay people now. Everybody does. Like, you know that that's not a realistic gay relationship. That's a weird movie relationship. But like everybody knows a gay person who acts like Agador Spartacus. He's single. He's outrageously flamboyant.
Guatemalan. You know,
and yeah, you're intimidated by his Guatemalan-ness. I think I have a friend who is Colombian who acts a little bit like that, except he's a little more posh and fashion forward rather than housekeeper-ish. He's the person who hires the housekeeper, not acts as the housekeeper.
Okay, so you think he's actually more true to an actual person that really exists than the Nathan Lane character is?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think the Nathan Lane character is realistic at all because, like I said earlier, he's a drag queen. And that's not how drag queens, when they're not in drag, act. That's painting with a really broad brush. Obviously, I'm generalizing. But drag queens are... I mean, shit, drag queens are the people who put on the Stonewall riots. They're not girly. They're not clutching their pearls, like literally in this movie. These are the people who, the reason that we have pride is because of them. Like, they're the people who stood up to the police and who took the fall for, you know, to normalize being gay.
Yeah, I couldn't see the main character doing that.
No, but I have, it's true. I mean, in my experience, every drag queen I've ever seen on TV, in the movies, whatever, it's always like a very, in like the news or interviewing some real drag queen person.
Yeah.
It's always some kind of macho tough guy.
Yeah. It's woman. Macho, but not butch.
Right. It's a tough, I mean, hell, feminine person.
Look at RuPaul when RuPaul is confronted for being not politically correct enough. I mean, he doesn't care. He doesn't give a shit what you think about what he has to say. He's going to say it. He's going to be himself. He's going to express his opinions. And he's as far as I'm concerned, RuPaul's better than Kanye when it comes to, you know, representing a like minority class and being authentic to himself.
I don't think RuPaul's aged today.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with RuPaul. I mean,
you know who RuPaul is, though.
I know who RuPaul is. I'm just not familiar with his political opinions or whatever.
RuPaul is not woke. I don't know about political opinions, but RuPaul is un-PC and anti-PC and like a huge inspiration to, I think, a lot of people who want to remain subversive and countercultural.
Okay, so what is the counterculture then on the left? Because there's some question about there being whether they seem to be the dominant culture, but yet they still feel like they're the victim class or they're being oppressed, so they're still the counterculture. So is there a legitimate counterculture on the left?
No. Well, okay. There are leftists like, I don't know. Jimmy Dore is the one who's always like trotted out as the non-PC leftist. I don't know. I mean, he's fine, but he's pretty milquetoast and vanilla. Excuse me. I burped. That's really professional. in our sphere, in our milieu, like Magnus Panvidia, for instance, is a, I don't know how he identifies sexually. I think he's bi. He's a mutualist, which is sort of an offshoot of left anarchism. He's real active in the Boogaloo movement, but also on quote bottom unity, where the, you know, libertarian left and libertarian right are coming together. I guess I consider that left wing countercultural, but in the like authoritarian left, the people who are woke and PC and so forth, there isn't a counterculture. They are the culture. They're the drivers of everything. And you just have to look at, I mean, the fact that I'm using a Snapchat filter that is just painting me in rainbows tells you where the culture is at. I mean, if we were in a right wing culture, you know, I would have the crucifix or something on me or whatever. Like,
it's, yeah, that filter would not exist.
Yeah, yeah. There is no left-wing counterculture. There are a handful of people who truly believe that the Republican Party is still dominated by the religious right. There are many more people who use the religious right of the 80s and 90s as ammunition to try to convince their would-be allies that they're up against this religious right that doesn't really exist anymore. But for the most part,
I think of the religious right as being like Babylon B stuff. Like they've got a sense of humor about it.
Yeah.
They
are subversive.
And they don't care how you live your life as long as you're not imposing your stuff on them.
Right. They're very much not impositional.
I was a lefty before, like I was a huge Howard Dean fan back in 2004. Yeah, exactly. But back then and this is only 15 years ago. God. like 15 years ago or so, the left wing like catchphrase was you don't legislate morality. And that was while the religious right was like in their sort of descent, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you don't legislate morality until you're the predominant drivers of culture. And in that case, you know, if you don't legislate morality, then you use your propaganda arm of the state, Twitter, Facebook, the media, et cetera.
The bully pulpit to bash people over the head with your morality.
Yeah. And that's where I guess we can get a little bit more political again, but I'm firmly of the opinion that Twitter and Facebook and Goldman Sachs and all these companies that are just super, super woke. And I know woke is a terrible word. Like it's a word that right wingers use to describe left wingers. It's not a word that left wingers use to describe themselves. So we're trying to come up with a different word for that phenomenon. But right now it's just going to be woke. These entities, these organizations that a lot of libertarians call private companies so they can do whatever the hell they want. Like they're not, they're arms of the state. They're arms of the powers that be. In a lot of cases, they are the powers that be. I mean, in the case of the banks, especially, I mean, the banks and the military industrial complex are the drivers of politics. It's not like it's only the formal bureaucracies and you know, legislatures and the branches of government that are the state. It's all of these drivers of culture that we have to resist as, you know, libertarians and as counterculturalists, if we want to be countercultural.
Not for the sake of being countercultural, but for the sake of human freedom.
Yeah. I think it's probably inevitable, though. I mean, if my little framework of the propositional to impositional oscillation of eras is correct, and I think it is, we're probably in for a little bit more hurting before it gets better.
Yeah, I think Jeff Dice calls it the imposers and the imposed upon. I think that was a speech that he gave maybe a year ago.
Yeah,
that was a really good one. But Michael Malice, he keeps talking about a white pill, and I keep like thinking, okay, where is it, buddy? Where is it? And he's talking about, you know, the lack of faith in mainstream reporting and the skepticism that's kind of returning or seemingly returning as they get caught sort of manipulating information and censoring dissenting opinions and things like that. Though he goes back to that outscaled like appearance of power where those who are aware of it aren't aware of others who are aware of it, you know? So it still seems like we're vastly outnumbered. I've lamented many times on this show in the past year that it's worse off than I ever imagined. Like we are so far more outnumbered than I ever thought, you know, but then there are sometimes like glimmers of hope and, you know, maybe I'll have to read, I've been listening to a lot of, you know, Michael Malice's interviews recently, cause he's on like a promotional thing for the Anarchist Handbook, which is really just a compilation of writings by anarchist thought, you know, across many, you know, different kind of perspectives. But the fact that, I guess one of the white pills is the fact that it's, that a book like that, that even introduces these ideas into the culture is popular is a white pill in and of itself. It's sort of like how this movie, The Birdcage, was introduced into the culture to help advance sort of normalization or acceptance of, you know, gay people or just being gay and that being okay. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
that episode, excuse me, that episode of Seinfeld was also formative, not quite as formative as The Birdcage, but it was great. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah. And then Will and Grace came out right around this time too.
I didn't watch Will and Grace until 2013 or so. My ex had every season on DVD. So we always watched it, but that's not really my cup of tea, I don't think.
Okay. All right. Well, we should honestly get back to the movie, but I do have a question for you. You mentioned your partner not offended by much, if anything. Are they woke? Are they progressive? Are they, because it seems as if people like that are offended by anything. So I'm just curious, like, or have you influenced his thought, like politically or culturally, like as being now the subversive, like, you know, freedom oriented type person?
I always joke that he's a better anarchist than I am, because not only, like, he doesn't vote, not because he has like some political principle that tells him not to vote, but just because, like, mathematically your vote doesn't count. So what's the point? He just doesn't have positions on things like that. That said, he has lots of trans and non-binary friends. So he's very progressive when it comes to gender and sexual things like that. It's just that he doesn't see it through like a political lens. A couple of things that he is, I don't want to like tell tales out of school, but a couple of things that he is like passionate about are like corporate hegemony and he doesn't like the fact that when you work for a company, that company basically has free reign over at least 40 hours, if not more, every week of your life. We also got into a little bit of a not argument, but a disagreement about hiring a housekeeper. I don't like
cleaning. I think his area comes to mind now.
Yeah. Well, I don't like cleaning the house. He doesn't like cleaning the house. So I thought, why don't we hire a housekeeper? And the idea of having someone like doing your just menial, dirty, gross work to him is incredibly offensive. He, like, it's just one step above slavery. But to me, it's like, you know, this person chose to go into that line of work. So, you know, you might as well, I mean, it's either me, who's a nice person, or, you know, some crazy old lady who's going to be just complete horrible old lady to her. I almost said a C word. you know, I mean, to me, it's like, you know, this person wants to be a maid. That's what they signed up for. But for him, it's like, no. She doesn't want to be a maid. She needs the money. Like, and you know, I guess he's got a point. You know, it's not, I don't work for a living because I want a job. I work for a living because I want money. And if my only skill was cleaning houses, I'm terrible at cleaning houses, so don't ever hire me to be your housekeeper. But if it was, then, you know, maybe I'd hate that job too. Not that I hate my job, if any of my coworkers are listening. But, you know, I mean,
he loves it.
I happen to know a housemaid person, and this person really enjoys cleaning houses. It's very therapeutic. It's very, she's like almost OCD about a messy space.
Yeah.
So she goes into a messy space, makes it clean. It's very therapeutic. So
I know people like
on
that.
On top of the money, they also just enjoy it.
Yeah.
And specialize in it and are good at it. Yeah.
That will not convince my partner. Which, fair, you know, enough. I mean, it's fine.
Those people do exist.
Yeah. We bought a Roomba. That's the big thing, is getting the dog hair off the floor. We got a Roomba. Right. It's going to be fine.
Did you see our Matrix series? Now you're enslaving a Roomba.
Well, that's all right. It's part of the Matrix. I'll do whatever I can, man.
It's going to rise up and overthrow you guys.
Yeah. hey, I know, but apparently Roomba, I did all the Consumer Reports stuff when I was like researching robot vacuums. Apparently Roomba, or its parent company, I think it's iRobot, is pretty good on data privacy and all that, which I didn't think that was even a potential issue when it came to robot vacuums, but it is. I guess.
So like, the robot reports what it's cleaning or picking up, or there's a little camera.
I have no idea, dude. Maybe it has something to do with transmitting your Wi-Fi. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that was a big deal, mm-hmm. because like some Amazon devices were about to like share Wi-Fi interconnectedness, right, or something.
Yes. It was like Amazon neighborhood or something. I'm a complete hypocrite. I've got a house full of
Alexa
or something
devices. Yeah. Oh shit, that triggered her. Oh god, her light just came on.
Alexa, what time is it?
I'm afraid I can't do that, Hal.
I know. It's just
what's your current location, Alexa? Yeah.
But anyway, so yeah, I have a house full of these things, but I definitely opted out of that creepy. I think it like networks all of the Ring cameras in on your block or something like that to help the cops catch criminals ostensibly, but really it's just surveillance.
It's the Batman freaking Dark Knight movie.
Oh yes. That's precisely what it is.
Wow. Ugh.
Yeah, we had some moral quandaries about that. That was a question that you raised in that episode way back when. Dark Knight episode.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow.
Man.
It's coming true.
Through your Roomba.
And your Alexa.
All right. Well, hey, we've been barely talking about this movie and we're already out of time. So we're going to need to get into last notes, final summary and review. Give it however many mambas out of, or what's the
Buffon wigs? How about a Buffon wig?
Yeah, Buffon wigs. Okay, out of 10. So anyone have any final notes on this one?
I took zero notes throughout the entire movie, so I have no final notes either.
Okay, all right. James, any notes or anything that's spontaneously come up?
Yeah, there's a few things. So I saw it when I was a kid. I saw it again. I've seen it several times. I've just recently watched it, obviously. A few things that stand out. They raised their son to be weird. Like, I don't know if you noticed this or not, but like whenever their son walks into their house, he like gropes their statue's balls, which is a little strange. I don't think that's realistic. I don't know any gay couples with kids. I don't think that's realistic. They also, when the son first, his very first scene, they made it look like he and Robin Williams were having an affair, because like they kissed and it was just a little creepy. I thought that they treated the offspring relationship just kind of weird, and I don't think that's realistic. Maybe it made sense in 1990, whatever, but it doesn't ring true now. Other than that, I think it's a great movie. I think everybody should see it. More than seeing this movie, though, if in your area, I don't know if it's a musical or just a stage play, but if La Cage aux Folles is touring in your area, get tickets and go see it. It is the funniest damn play I've ever seen in my life. There's a drag queen who performs like during scene changes and stuff. It is just so good. So highly recommend that. It's expensive, but go anyway. And I give it, what are we doing? Are we doing bird cages?
Buffon wigs? Sure, man.
Buffon wigs out of 5?
Out of 10.
Out of 10. Okay, I give it, I don't know, like 9.5. It's such a good movie.
Whoa.
But it's nostalgic. That's the thing. I would give Empire Records like 8 out of 10 records, and that's a terrible movie. So like just, I have bad taste in media. That's just what it is. Sorry.
Okay. All right. So we're gonna grade you on a curve, I think.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
All right, so that's interesting. I did not notice the son grasping balls on the statues at all. I might actually have to like go back and look, because that's interesting that they would have something like that that's noticeable enough that you would call it out. I did think that the scene of like, and they're telling the story, they're trying to make you think that Robin Williams is in fact having an affair, because that's what Nathan Lane is worried about. And right. Robin Williams is like acting all cagey, you know, and trying to sneak up there. And then it's sort of like this aha kind of reveal. No, that's actually his son. But I can see them doing that for, you know, storytelling purposes to kind of give a little, you know, twist or whatever. But yeah, it's once you kind of are aware of it, you're like, yeah, that was not so great. But
did anybody else feel bad for the kid? Because he had a terrible mom that wasn't at all interested in his life or know anything about him.
Nathan Lane was a terrific mom. I don't know what you're talking about.
The biological,
yes, the biological mom didn't even know his name, right?
Yeah.
Didn't even know his name. In one scene, she called him like a different name or something like that.
Yeah. I don't know. It kind of seemed to be like an agreement, maybe like
clearly she didn't want to be a mom.
Yeah.
Him raise the kid, but still, wouldn't you have some interest in your offspring?
She is the caricature of what Rush Limbaugh would have called a feminazi. I mean, even like, look how she opened the champagne bottle. She puts it between her legs like a dick and like squeezes out the cork and it explodes like she's coming. I mean, she's just another caricature of a 90s feminist, doesn't care about her kids because she's a career woman. It's, you know, I don't know. I think she's a very hollow, shallow character.
Yeah, she's played over the top. I find it hard for anybody. I know that there are plenty of sperm donors out there that don't know their kids, whatever. But anybody who's given birth, and I know there are people, women that give up their kids for adoption and kind of want to forget their past or whatever, but it didn't seem like that was the case here. And it didn't, I mean, they're both living basically in the same town, right? The kid, yeah. Wasn't the kid still like living in town or not? Or he was visiting from somewhere else?
He was going to school in New Jersey.
Okay. But still, I feel like, anyway, I know she's a caricature, like you said, but it seemed like she was unnecessarily a terrible mom.
Yeah.
Yeah, or not a mom, really.
Right.
But
womb donor.
Yeah, and they did make it sound like she knew that Robin Williams' character was gay when she had sex with him. And sort
of like, they were in like a play together. And so, you know, he wanted to experience it once. Lose his gold star, as we say.
Right. See what it's all about. You know, experiment, you know.
All right, I'm going to give mine out of gold stars.
Ah, good, good. Yes.
All right. So we're changing from bouffant wigs to gold stars. So I'm gonna give mine and then we'll go to Robert. So The Birdcage, I enjoyed this movie way back when it came out, when I saw it in the theaters back in 1996. I think that it was more of a cultural kind of icon and it was introducing ideas into the culture and it was more subversive. And watching it now, it doesn't have that same oomph factor to it. I still enjoy the performances. I love Robin Williams as an actor. Nathan Lane's performance, though over the top, is still well done. Hank Azaria is probably my favorite character in this, of course. Gene Hackman does a fine job playing the caricature of a right-wing conservative hypocrite. But story-wise, I don't know what really gets resolved in this. It does sort of allude to some things maybe left on the cutting room floor as far as like the narrative structure of the story. So I'm going to give it just 5 gold stars out of 10. It's a movie that, you know, I'll remember. It stood out, unlike a movie we were talking about in the pre-show, bonus content, that starred Paul Rudd at LARPing. It's a pretty forgettable movie, though I'd probably enjoy watching that movie more than I enjoyed watching Birdcage, which is sort of this weird, you know, juxtaposition. But anyway, 5 gold stars from me, and Robert, will go to you.
All right. So is The Birdcage worth watching in 2021? Like Daniel said, it's conquered territory. This is the movie that it's like watching, like nobody watches Guess Who's Coming to Dinner anymore. It's conquered territory. Nobody cares about the scandalousness of a girl bringing home a black man for dinner. I mean, maybe that exists somewhere in the world, but it doesn't exist in Hollywood in 2021. That's not where the cultural milieu zeitgeist exists anymore. So nobody cares about that. Nobody cares about the scandalousness of being gay or having a gay person in your family or marrying into a gay family or whatever. It would just be, yeah, those are my gay uncles, whatever. It doesn't matter. So you're right. It's not pushing any boundaries because it's already been done and there and the culture has moved on. But I still found that the story for a movie that takes place in a day to be quite beginning, middle, and an end. And there's a nice climax at the end with the dinner scene. All the characters really play out and you really feel who they are. You've got the senator's wife who has her moments. Like every character is there for a reason. It's got something to do. Is kind of cookie cutter as the son and the daughter are, who, you know, they're Romeo and Juliet and the families just aren't going to get together and agree with each other on anything. But there's enough here that it was enjoyable, even seeing it before and even it not being, you know, any kind of real cultural relevant. It's still strong, like strong performances, well-written for the most part, even if it didn't make me laugh. I still have to recommend it. In 2021, I think it's worth watching. I'm going to give this 7 Gene Hackman's in a dress. out of 10. It's not great looking, but worth watching.
Gene Hackman in a platinum blonde wig. Let's not forget.
That's right. In a Marilyn Monroe maybe outfit. I don't know. Yeah. What was that? Whatever that was.
He was very pretty.
Oh, very, very coming.
Oh man, yeah, they could have done the flowy dress over the event. That would have been funny.
Oh, that would have been a good scene. Yeah. He goes out, yeah, stands on the grate.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, hey, James, this has been a lot of fun, and I hope that we weren't too forward in our conversation. But and I feel like we talked about the movie a little. So, you know, that's what we do here a little bit. But yeah, this is a lot of fun, and we'd love to have you back on again in the near future. We had talked about maybe doing network at some point. That was in the running for tonight.
It was. And
this one went out because it's the back end of Pride Month. And anyway,
wanted to slip it in there.
I got more jokes coming up. Don't you worry. But anyway, where can people find your show? And of course, they can find the links on our show notes page at lastnerds.com/183.
Yeah. So subscribe to my show and whatever written content I do put out at blackbird.substack.com. I'm toying with the idea of buying a domain for that just because that's kind of a long thing, but blackbird.substack.com. Follow me on Twitter at James L J. And I think, yeah, that's probably about the good place for people to find me at this point.
All right. Sounds good. We will also have links to your palomaverde.cbd.com. And use the code Blackbird for 25% off at checkout. And we will also have a link to your previous appearance when you're talking about High Rise with us, which is a movie that Robert did not like, unlike this one, which he did like. So Mikey likes it. I'm quite impressed. All right.
This is an example, and libertarians should take notice of a way to forward your ideas. It's a way to You don't make it a big deal that Robin Williams is gay, but you just have him be a nice guy, and he also happens to be gay. I mean, I guess part of the movie is the point is that he's gay, but for him, he's not like fighting for acceptance about who he is. He's just who he is, and he doesn't give a shit. And he's like, yeah, I don't care if some dumb senator accepts me for being who I am or not. So you have a cool character who's libertarian, and he does cool shit, and he just happens to be libertarian. Make movies like that. That'd be great.
And we'll review it. And hopefully it'll be good. Better than the, what was it? The Alice Shrugged series?
Alice Shrugged. Oh, my God.
Yeah, progressively worse.
Yet, but,
we have not done those.
Don't. You might like inspire someone to watch them. Out of morbid curiosity.
All right. Are you guys ready for the terrible joke?
Yeah.
Hit me.
All right. Next week, we're going to go from ass to mouth as we go from the birdcage, talking about the back end of Pride Month, to Jaws as we introduce Snobby Bobby back again to do a 4th of July episode. He was on last year for the 4th of July as we did The Patriot, the Mel Gibson classic. And this year, we're going to be doing Jaws with him. So I am shoehorning in a terrible, terrible joke that I'm sure people don't even understand at this point. And I think that's what makes it even funnier for me. So Jaws next week, everyone, with Snobby Bobby of the Not For Everyone podcast. One of my favorite podcasts, I might add. Also Blackbird.
Oh, man.
Available for wherever podcasts are sold.
Are we going to get into the critique of capitalism probably thing?
I think that we should, yes. I'm going to watch that again. And there's also some...
By what's his name? Sloboda
Zizek?
Zizek, that's right.
Yes, and that was something that Pete Quinones recommended that we check out. So I think that will play a role in our conversation. So I think that'll be a lot of fun.
Can't disagree.
All right. Well, James, any final words for our audience? And then we will get into some Kathleen Turner Overdrive, which is some bonus content where we get even more risque.
More risque?
Patreon. Oh, yeah.
Okay, I was going to drop a C-bomb as my final word, but I'll keep that for the more risque part.
All right, you guys got to pay up for that C-bomb. All right, well, hey, this has been a lot of fun. We'll see you guys all next week with Snobby Bobby as we talk about Jaws for the Independence Day, 4th of July. And with that, we'll say goodnight from last night, everyone. Peace out. All right, and we'll continue the transmission for just another minute on the Actual Anarchy podcast. Sorry, I cut you off there, James. I didn't realize you were about to say something. I'm sure it was going to be very enlightening. And what were you saying? You were saying something about good night, maybe?
All I said was thanks, boys.
Thanks, boys. All right.
That's it.
Riveting content. Riveting content.
Man. Yeah, a couple like, just kidding. I'm saying it.
Yeah, you're going to say the C word. All right. So I have this might be risque. And this comes from a group of guys that you were once associated with, but I don't think that you are any longer. But it's guys who are very anti-19th Amendment. I think you'll know who I'm talking about.
What's the 19th Amendment? Hang on. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. What is the 19th Amendment?
Women having the right to vote.
Oh, professional asshole?
Yes. Professional asshole.
Oh, okay. Professional asshole. I love that dude.
Right. Though he said that you would say that. And he said to tell that FA990T that he's not a nice person.
No, he's not. But he bought me a really nice dinner one time. And, you know, we keep in contact every so often. The thing is, I mean, Facebook was our primary way of keeping in contact. Once the Tom Woods group dissolved on Facebook, we kind of fell out of contact. I still consider him a friend. If I'm ever down or up in his area again, I will certainly meet up with him. And if he's listening, I love you, professional asshole. And thanks for dinner.
Depending on where you put the comma, you know, you could read that a couple of different ways.
I like him.
It's okay. All right. Well, why don't we get into some Kathleen Turner Overdrive, which is available for the Patreon supporters. Go to actualanarchy.com/Patreon and you'll hear our guest James and the C word. Robert, any final words? I mean, usually say something about getting merch from utrepster.com or living their lives, subscribing, right? Giving us a review, sending money our way.
Yeah, money. Money's good. Money.
I like
money. There's a lot of it out there these days. There's so much money. It's ridiculous. So,
and Biden doesn't even know it.
Just give it to us. Give me.
I'm old. That's give me money.
I don't have any words of wisdom. This was a lot of fun. Thanks, James, for coming on. You're welcome back anytime. Hopefully for a less gay movie.
We have a couple in the pipeline. I think Daniel and I have been discussing this for like a year.
Things. And there's a couple of ones for Halloween times.
I think. Yeah. We're good.
Yeah.
Cool. Hey, have y'all seen the Conjuring movies?
No.
Okay. We just binge watched everything in the Conjuring universe and then went and saw the new one in the theater. It's not fit for this show, but man, it's a great, it's a great series of movies. Like some of them are cheesy, but you know,
how many are there?
There's a bunch. Holy shit. Mm. It's like all the Conjuring movies. So there's three of those, all the Annabelle movies. I think there's three or four of those. La Llorona, which was terrible. But that's in it too. And then The Nun, which was almost as bad as La Llorona.
Are these the slow burn ring styles horror or is this jump scare? Okay.
Nope. They're slow burn ring style. There's jump scares. They're 21st century horror movies, but they're definitely in the vein of The Ring and Insidious and Blair Witch. And
you signed me up for like a 9 or 10 hour thing?
Dude.
Or longer?
Way more. Like,
It's like a 40-hour week job.
Yeah.
All right.
So anyway, we binged all of them and then saw the latest Conjuring, which was really good. The thing is, there's formulas to these movies.
Is there
obviously
a best? Is there a best that we can just pick one?
Like a one that is representative, but also the best of the bunch.
You kind of have to see them in order. They're sequels.
Oh no. Okay.
And the thing is, they're intertwined. So it's like Stephen King books. Like you can read the Stephen King books, but if you read the Stephen King books without reading the Dark Tower series, you're not getting the full like Stephen King universe impact.
Right. That's what I'm hesitant to recommend. He was telling us all the stuff about Derry and how things are interconnected and like it is actually this alien thing or whatever. And it's mentioned in all the other books. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I like that kind of stuff where there's like this thread bringing it all together, you know, like, reminds me of a Rothbard quote where there's all these problems in the world and there's a red thread weaving them all together, causing a lot of them, and it's government. Yeah. So I'll end on that, and we'll get into some Kathleen Turner Overdrive right after this. You can find the show notes more at actualanarchy.com/240. Find James's prior appearance discussing High Rise and also his palomaverde.cbd.com link and promo code Blackbird, and also link to his show. blackbird.substack.com. Thank you so much, James. It's been a lot of fun. And we will have you drop the C word right after this for our Patreon supporters. Maximum nice. Freedom, everyone. Peace out.
Chipmunks. C-H-I-P-M-U-N-K. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do-do. Do-do-do-do. Do-do. Do-do-do-do.